Thank you very much. Chairman Heineman, members of the council, our dear and respected friend, A. Philip Randolph, whose hallmark of character is his great sense of integrity. Philip, I feel as if I am privileged today to deliver a rather extended benediction to an inspiring invocation by you, sir. The first lines of my remarks to this historic conference is, we know why we are here. And indeed, we've heard the call. And we've heard the call to action sounded by President Johnson at Howard University. A call challenging America to move from opportunity to achievement, to realize not just equality as a right and a theory, but equality as a fact and equality as a result. Now, we know the intensive work which hundreds of persons have expended in preparing for this conference, the spirited deliberations of the planning session in November, the reports of task forces and panels, and the challenging report and recommendations prepared by the council to this conference. I trust that each and every one of us has studied that report and the recommendations included therein carefully. But we're here to go to work. And there is much work to be done. In a few short years, we've traveled down a road studded with landmarks, historic court decisions, legislative victories, and executive actions. And as we've traveled that road, we've seen 1,000 acts of heroism, large and small, by the brave and determined Americans who have made that journey with us. Men and women of both races struggling to secure the reality of freedom, the reality of equality and human dignity. And of course, we rejoice in these victories, as we rejoice in the knowledge that the troop of travelers, but a handful of courageous marchers a few years ago, has swelled to a mighty tide of humanity. But our task at this conference, as it will be America's most urgent domestic task for many years to come, is not to recount the progress of the past, but to fulfill the promise of the future. Now, this will be a hard, sometimes unglamorous, frequently frustrating responsibility. We can rejoice that the time has arrived when millions of Negro Americans can step out of the shadows and walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights. But a man too long walled off from society cannot easily adjust his senses and his capacities to the light, yes, and the heat of equality. This generation of Americans has the task, and I add the priceless opportunity, of walking side by side with the Negro American as he strides into that bright sunshine and stands erect, equipped, and trained for his opportunity. Now, as we see the work before us, we cannot avoid the realization that many times our deeds have not matched our words, that there still exists a tragic gap separating promise from performance in the many crucial areas of civil rights policy. What more explicit documentation of this do we need than was given to us this morning by A. Philip Randolph. And that performance gap that I refer to must be closed. The blame for that gap cannot be laid at the feet of any single person or institution. Every major segment of our society has contributed to maintaining this gap between promise and performance. So we ask the question, how are we to close it? Well, the first requirement is to concede that it exists. Unflinching, unblinking candor is an absolute necessity if we are to prevail, as prevail we must, in the new stage, the new stage of the civil rights battle. Now, as I see it, here are the major areas where we must do much better. First, the federal government has the job of meeting its growing responsibilities. And I have no doubt that this topic will receive more than its share of attention in the next 2 days. But permit me this observation as a member of the federal establishment. Despite the federal government's absolute commitment to achieving equality for all Americans and its accomplishments of the past and those which will be evident in the future, we welcome constructive evaluation and criticism of our efforts to implement all civil rights statutes and policies and to carry forward our struggle against deprivation and discrimination. And on behalf of President Johnson, I give you this pledge. The federal government will improve its performance wherever that is necessary. We will not shirk our responsibility. Secondly, states and local governments have often failed to exercise meaningful initiative in a wide spectrum of civil rights issues. Now, this deficiency is especially acute because it is in the state houses, the city halls, and the local town meetings, not just the halls of Congress or the federal courtrooms, where the major battles of the next phase of the civil rights struggle will be waged. It is in our states and local communities where we must gear ourselves for action and wage war against what I prefer to call America's shame, slumism. Let me describe for you this ugly term, slumism, related, of course, to the ghettos that have been spoken of this morning in our cities. Slumism encompasses poverty, illiteracy, and disease. Slumism is discrimination and frustration and bitterness. Slumism is the ungathered garbage, if you please, and the dilapidated buildings. Slumism is a family of 8 or 10 in an unheated room. Slumism is danger on the stair and violence in the street. Slumism is rent so high that a desperate man is either moved to tears or to crime. Slumism is segregated, inferior schooling for those who so urgently need the best. Slumism is inflicting upon our less fortunate citizens the burden of dependency and despair, rather than stimulating their capacity for self-support and self-respect. Slumism is the pent-up anger of people living on the outside of affluence. Slumism is the decay of structure and the deterioration of the human spirit. Slumism is the other America. The other America that so few of us seem to know. The America of the poor. The America of the deprived. Of the unwanted. But we can defeat Slumism. And we can defeat it only if state and local leadership, working hand in hand with the federal government and the private groups, reasserts itself in bold and relentless fashion. Thirdly, business and labor unions must move more effectively towards the goal of equal employment opportunity and achievement. I know and I applaud the progress which has been made in the past years. Of course, there are countless stories of individual success which would have been impossible a decade ago. How well some of us realize this that have been in this battle so long. And I've seen the statistics and the charts which demonstrate the rate of progress for Negro Americans in certain job categories and prove, at least to the man that draws the chart and recites the statistics, that everything is getting better. But to the unemployed, and often the unemployable, man in Harlem or Woodlawn or Watts, these individual stories of success and the encouraging statistics are largely meaningless and sometimes insulting. When the statistical base, that baseline, is sufficiently low, any improvement, any increase, tends to look better than it actually is. The good news that a Negro has been appointed general counsel of a major corporation brings little hope into the life of a man who failed to complete fifth grade in a second-rate school. So, in all candor, I will speak within my own criteria, the criteria that I ask you to apply to this conference. We must face honestly the mammoth employment problem which still exists for most Negroes. Outmoded training programs, tests, recruitment and personnel procedures, apprenticeship requirements, and promotion patterns often deny equal employment achievement as effectively as the old-fashioned white-only Negroes need not apply sign that used to hang outside the factory gate. Now, your counsel, introduced here this morning, has recommended a number of steps dealing with economic security, job opportunity, and welfare. And these proposals merit careful attention and detailed discussion in the next 2 days. Finally, among the most potentially effective agents in our struggle to fulfill the rights of all Americans are our churches and our synagogues, service and professional organizations, and other community groups. The heroism of James Reeb or a Jonathan Daniels has stirred the conscience and the soul of our America. Many religious denominations and local congregations have given heartening evidence of their determination to infuse the concepts of brotherhood, yes, of love and justice, with real meaning and substance. As the foreleader of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, I can tell you that without the help of our churches, without the help of our spiritual leaders, I doubt that we could have achieved the victory. But let us say honestly what we also know to be true. Some local churches still erect racial barriers at their doors, and many more do not speak out affirmatively on the urgent questions of racial justice which arise in our communities. Many service, professional, and community organizations likewise remain silent in times of crisis. And the civil rights crisis is not political or even economic. It is moral. Dante said that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who in a period of moral crisis maintain their neutrality. I'm sure that you'll agree with me that in this struggle for equality, there can be no neutrality, nor can there be any so-called conscientious objectors. Now imagine the cumulative impact of these organizations of which I have spoken, uniting in behalf of racial justice and equality. The report of your council describes Project Equality, a national program in which religious organizations use their hiring and purchasing power to promote equal employment opportunity. Consider the effect if every major religious denomination and local congregation actively participated in this program. We have at our disposal vast reservoirs of untapped economic and social power to unleash against the accumulated discriminations and disabilities which afflict so many Negro Americans. This conference could make no finer contribution to the general welfare of America than mobilizing these resources without further delay. We must, however, appreciate the difficulty of the remaining problems and the dangers inherent in a period necessarily marked by frustration and disappointment. Events and trends of this period, my fellow Americans, will often strain the patience and the forbearance of many well-meaning people, black and white. The days ahead will be turbulent and at times very frustrating. Indeed, we will require a depth of maturity and understanding seldom achieved on such controversial social and economic issues. Today, there are some Americans who see racial separation and exclusion as the remedy for racial injustice and the evils of the past. Now, segregation was a major factor in producing the hate and the injustices that we're seeking to overcome. Do we really believe that more segregation or more separation will still this hate and overcome this injustice? I think not. No, our entire American experience cries out against this approach. And our history books are filled with the failures of prior separatist movements. One fact seems patently clear. The goal of freedom now will be attained precisely to the degree that we are successful in enlisting additional sources of strength in our march towards equality and justice. Then, too, today there are some Americans who wonder whether the struggle for civil rights will ever be over. They ask in a pleading voice, what else can we possibly do after all the laws that we've passed? Well, we should have learned by now that laws and court decisions can only point the way, set the standards. They can establish criteria of right or wrong, and they can provide a basis for rooting out the evils of bigotry and racism, but the laws themselves cannot wipe away centuries of oppression and injustice. It's people, we the people, that must wipe out that oppression and injustice. And we should have learned also that social revolutions, and that is what we have, that social revolutions do not necessarily proceed on the basis of some predetermined, comfortable timetable. I'm quite sure that George III thought our founding fathers quite unreasonable. I can imagine what he thought of Patrick Henry and Samuel Adams and John Hancock and a few others. I suppose he thought them even blatantly irresponsible as they pressed their demands to their necessary conclusion, far beyond what the English must surely have felt were the bonds of good taste and the dictates of knowing one's place in life. Well, today, my friends, there are Americans, and many of them law enforcement officials, who quite properly see a danger to law and order in the flaring of anger and the release of tightly coiled tensions by the Americans who live in our squalid ghettos. But these Americans would compound the danger by responding not with even-handed justice to the few, but to the heavy-handed, indiscriminate retaliation against the many. And today there are other Americans who see in the struggle for freedom and equality a license for irresponsibility and violence. They are both wrong, tragically, explosively wrong. And they must realize they are wrong and realize it now, while there is still time to seek racial harmony and justice in America. There is, in short, an urgent need to build a new climate of mutual respect among all elements of society. For it is this absence of respect, yes, Philip, this absence of acceptance of a fellow human being and the sense of responsibility which is engendered by respect, which lies at the roots of the hostility and the suspicion which today threatens the tranquility and the progress of some of our cities, yes, of all America. Today there are Americans, some of them on human rights commissions, who appear more concerned about preserving the status quo than rooting out the long-standing injustices facing residents of their community. Now, I do not wish to be misunderstood in this point. Most human relations groups serve their communities with justice, wisdom, and courage, facing issues honestly and seeking equitable solutions to complex and difficult matters. But in some cities, the fact is that this is not the case. And where those instances are revealed and exist, they must be corrected now. And I can say with considerable regret that there are even some Negro Americans who appear more concerned about their own positions than about the plight of the less fortunate. About the plight of the less fortunate, less articulate members of their race. And I hold up as a standard for all Americans the man who spoke to us this morning, A. Philip Randolph. Consciously or unconsciously, their interest seems not in securing the fruits of equality for their brothers, but regrettably preserving their own personal good fortune and accomplishments. Now, to both groups, and I can see that I'm making very few friends with this candid evaluation, but I'm not here in a popularity contest. I'm here as an act of conscience. To both groups, the lesson of the revolution of rising expectations, which is not only in the foreign countries, but is here at home in America, must be writ large. That lesson, 20 million Americans will no longer be pacified by slogans or tokens. They will not be satisfied. They shall not be moved, nor should they be, by such slogans or tokens. For freedom now is not a catchword for a minority of Americans. It is a moral imperative for all Americans. And we can strive towards it. To the credit of each of us, we can defer it or distort it or deceive those who seek it. But we do so at our peril. We can achieve it only through specific deeds, hard, visible evidence that performance is linked with promise and fulfillment is an element of faith. This conference, ladies and gentlemen, is America's opportunity to begin. Now, to some persons, certain recommendations found in the consul's report will appear to be radical and outside traditional American procedures and practices. I'm not unaccustomed to having that sort of thing said. But in evaluating these proposals, it is essential to pose this question to those who think the consul may have gone too far. What are the alternatives? What are the alternatives? My fellow Americans, if nothing is done to reduce the unemployment among Negroes, still about twice the rate for whites. And what can we expect if the 20% unemployment rate for Negro youth is not reduced? What are the alternatives if we fail to eliminate segregated schools in both North and South and bring into balance the disparities in the quality of education? And you and I know there is a disparity, an intolerable one. What are the alternatives if we are unable to banish housing discrimination and do not expand substantially the amount of decent, low-priced housing available to all? What is the alternative? These are the questions which this conference and the entire nation must raise as these crucial problems are discussed and then attacked. These are the alternatives which must be weighed. We must find the answers. Now, I know I speak for President Johnson when I urge you upon you absolute frankness and honesty in these deliberations. I can assure you that your words, your deliberations will command the attention and the action of your government. This government is not afraid to seek freedom now for all Americans. But I trust that each of you will be searching for those areas of action which can be implemented by the states and the localities, by businesses and the labor unions, by private organizations and the churches and the synagogues and the people. For only as we mobilize all the resources and seek the commitment of all Americans can we achieve the momentum, the enduring, persevering momentum necessary to banish discrimination and denial from this land. So finally, I urge you, as I have done so across this country time after time, I urge all Americans to view the civil rights movement not in the harsh glare, the distorted reflection of today's headlines, but rather in the more balanced perspective of history. Do not allow your convictions to be uprooted, your steadfast course altered by the occasional excesses, the temporary aberrations, which history tells us must be experienced in any great movement towards social justice. History has a way of shrinking to proper size the episodes which capture the public's attention for a fleeting moment. And it has a way of raising to proper size acts of wisdom, of vision, and of courage. Today, as few generations in our history, ours has such an opportunity, an opportunity to transform a great nation into a great society. We ask no monuments. We ask only the judgment of history. Let the history books show that a great nation did not set its face against the tide of history, did not say, "Thus far you shall come, but no further." Instead, let the history books show that this great nation of America said, "There is no more room in America for a them and an us." There is but one America, one citizenship, and one destiny for all. And then we shall crown our good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. Thank you.